never goes away. There's not a day that goes by that I don't think of them. The pain becomes a part of you.
Get everybody out here to my house now!
He came home and found them, his entire family, gone.
I said, what are you talking about? What are you saying?
Is this real? Am I really here? It was surreal.
His fellow cops suspected him.
I did not do this. I did not do this.
She was upset. She felt like history was repeating itself.
He wanted to have women and his wife was getting in the way.
Were police just plain wrong?
It's like this Twilight Zone. Lies become truth and the truth becomes lies.
Maybe the real killer was still out there.
You have lied to the police about this case.
Yes, sir.
So devastating.
We knew that that was probably the key to solving this. 13 years. 13 years of hell.
Such an awful crime. The wife. The little boy and girl.
My kids are dead.
Shot at point blank range.
I was just dumbfounded. I was shocked what I saw.
How to comprehend it.
I said, what? What are you talking about? What are you saying?
The husband had an alibi.
Could he have slipped away for, say, 10 minutes?
He could have done anything, but he didn't.
13 years, three trials. Appeals, reversals, and changing stories.
The big picture here, Charles, for a lot of people is it sounds like a crock. It doesn't pass the sniff test.
There's a lot of things about this case that doesn't make sense.
It has been a long, winding pursuit of justice, as one family sees it.
It just gets more and more wrong. I kind of adopted this saying that when you enter into the courtroom, lies become truth, and the truth becomes lies.
But there is another side, another family, one which sees a terrible miscarriage of justice.
You wonder if everybody got three trials, how many people would, guilty people would be out walking the streets.
Mommy, there's a present for you.
But there's one indisputable truth. Kim, Jill, and Bradley Cam were nothing less than innocents lost that evening.
When do you miss them the most?
Every day. And I'll tell you, whoever said that time heals has never lost a child.
This goes in both people's pile.
I can tell you that time doesn't heal anything. The pain becomes a part of you.
Time. Turn the clock back to the year 2000, September 28th to be precise, a Thursday after work. The place, a church rec center gym in Georgetown, southern Indiana. A pickup basketball game was underway with the usual Thursday night guys.
This is just you guys getting together?
Just pride.
Having fun. Pride, a little bit of glory days, huh?
Yeah.
David Cam, a 36-year-old manager at a waterproofing business, was a regular.
You guys grow up with it. This is religion, right?
Yeah, we play a little basketball in Indiana.
That night after the game wrapped up, David headed straight home. He and his wife, Kim, had two children, Brad, a quiet 7-year-old, and little Jill, a spitfire 2 years younger. Usually, David helped Kim with the kids in the evening, but on this night, he was late, and he knew Kim wouldn't be happy about that.
They got to get their homework done before they went to bed, and I thought, she's going to be upset when I get home because I'm not there to help.
As he rolled into his driveway, he clicked the garage door opener. A nightmare awaited him.
Once the garage door raised up just above the hood of my truck, that's when I saw Kim.
She was down on the garage floor.
Yeah. Actually, at first I thought it was Jill laying there. I didn't realize it was Kim until I got out of my truck and ran into the garage, and then that's when I saw that it was Kim.
How do you take this in? It's too much to absorb.
It's indescribable, you know, what was going through my mind at the time. I can't put it into words.
Kim was still, bent slightly at the waist, a long pool of blood running from her head. The doors to her Bronco were open.
When do you look into the vehicle?
I don't remember how long it was, but after checking on Kim, being assured in my mind that she was gone, I just suddenly thought about the kids. Where are the kids? And my first instinct was to look into the Bronco. And I got up on the passenger seat and I could see more into the back. And that's when I saw Brad and Jill.
Jill, still buckled in on the back passenger side, was slumped over. There was blood in her hair. Next to her, Brad seemed to be clambering over the seat.
Was it apparent even in your shock that this was a gunshot event?
I did not know. I did not know how they had died.
So you're in there between the console?
Over top of the console. That's correct. That's how I got back in there and grabbed Brad.
Brad what? Felt warm to you, as you recall?
Yeah. And I thought maybe he might have a chance.
David had been an Indiana State Trooper for almost 11 years. That night in the garage, David says, his police training kicked in. It seemed to him that his daughter Jill was dead. But if there was even a whisper of a chance for his son Brad, David knew he had to get him out of the Bronco and give him CPR.
I picked him up and pulled him into me and turned around and went back out the same way that I came in.
Came out the passenger door and put him down on the garage floor and what, started working on him?
Exactly.
Were you getting any signs of anything?
I just remember looking at his face. And like with Jill, his eyes, there was no moisture and they were half shut. It was pretty obvious that he was gone.
And this has all happened in what, 45 seconds of your life?
Probably maybe a minute.
Kneeling on the bloody garage floor amidst the bodies of his family, David knew he had to get help.
Dave, get everybody out here to my house now!
Okay.
He called the Indiana State Police where he used to work.
Get everybody out here to my house!
Go to Dave Campbell's house now. Single pad. Okay, David, we got people on the way, okay?
Get everybody out here!
Come here. Everything's going to be okay, all right? We're going to get people...
Everything's not okay. Get everybody out here okay. Now!
They're coming. Go to Dave Cam's house now.
Okay.
Do you know what happened, David?
No.
David Cam's 13-year journey into hell was only minutes old. Your family dead. Murdered. How do you even begin to absorb that?
Just all these things spinning around inside my head. Is this real? Am I really here? It was surreal.
There was more pain, much more still to come. David Cam says he came home one night in the fall of 2000 to an unimaginable horror. His wife, little boy and girl had been murdered.
Get everybody out here to my house now!
Okay.
After trying unsuccessfully to revive his son, David ran across the street to a relative's home.
I heard the banging on the door.
David's Uncle Nelson was there.
David was beating on the door and hollering, "Nelson, Nelson, come quick. Somebody's killed my family. They're all dead. They're all dead."
Nelson dropped everything and raced over to David's garage.
I was just dumbfounded. I was shocked what I saw.
David yelled at him to check on Jill, his daughter, in the Bronco. And Nelson says he made his way carefully to the vehicle. Like David, he was a former state trooper and knew that crime scenes had to be preserved.
I looked in the back seat, and that's when I saw little Jill back there. I reached back, and I touched her on his arm or shoulder or something, and I said, "Jilly, Jilly, Jilly."
You knew she was gone, huh?
I knew she was gone. And I said, "Dave, I think they're all gone, buddy. I think they're all gone."
David lost it.
He actually went down to the ground, was laying on his back and rolling around and saying, Why did I have to go? Why did I have to go? Why not just stay with him?
Uncle Nelson managed to get David away from the garage.
Dave was trying his best to get back in. I wouldn't let him go back in.
So you really are the officer securing the scene?
I was trying to keep them out. I knew it had to be done because I knew we had a horrific scene here, a crime scene, and I wanted to make sure that I didn't do anything to hamper it.
David Cam says he was way beyond understanding anything that night, but the questions wouldn't stop.
Just all these things spinning around inside my head. Is this real? Am I really here? Did I really just find Kim and Brad and Jill as they are? You know, It was just, it was surreal.
That night was the end of everything David and Kim had built together. They'd met in the late 1980s. They were introduced by Marcy McLeod. Marcy had been best friends with Kim ever since ninth grade.
She was very quiet for the people that didn't know her, but very funny, very loyal, very sweet.
David and Kim married in 1989. They threw a big fun party, then got on with their lives. Kim in corporate accounting and David as an Indiana State Trooper, a career Kim had encouraged him to pursue.
Find that drunk driver that's out there.
Here he is in uniform being interviewed in the 1990s about road safety during the holidays. The big hat seemed tailor-made for David Kam. He was soon member of an elite emergency kind of SWAT team.
That is the Band of Brothers, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Kind of special weapons tactical group.
Right, exactly. Yeah, love those guys. I mean, they were talking about guys that you would literally die for.
But over time, after the kids were born, David wanted to spend more time with his family. So in May 2000, he went to work as a manager in his Uncle Sam Lockhart's business and left the Band of Brothers.
Boy, it must have been hard to leave, Dave.
You know, it was.
I mean, you had this good thing you're going to, and you wanted to have more of a life. But yet I can see how much you like
it really wasn't
being in law enforcement.
Yeah, I just felt like it was definitely, I was in a point in my life when I needed to make that change and I wanted to make that change. And I presumed that I would remain close with these guys, that they would always be my friends, and that they would always have my back if I ever needed them.
By September 2000, the Kams seemed to be living a picture-perfect life. Things were going well at home and at work. Kim was a totally engaged mother. David's uncle, Sam Lockhart, saw the Kam family all the time.
A great mom. She would run those kids everywhere. And the kids, they were like my grandkids.
Jill!
Little Jill, yeah.
Tell me about her.
She was a character. She really was. Just a funny little girl. If she didn't have your attention, she'd get it. She would have been very athletic. She was gifted in that way.
And Brad was the swimmer, right?
And he loved it. He was great at it. Being a father, I thought, this kid's good.
There were gatherings with David's sprawling extended family, the Lockharts, the descendants of nine brothers and sisters on David's mother's side. The Lockharts were so entrenched in this patch of southern Indiana that they had a road named after them, Lockhart Road, where David's family lived.
There could not have been a better place for us to be when all of this terrible stuff happened.
The awful news raced through two families that night. David's sister Julie was getting ready to go to bed when the phone rang.
I said, "What? What are you talking about? What are you saying?"
Julie went straight to her parents' house.
Mom had all the pictures of Brad and Jill, I guess, that she could gather up, and was holding them. And just sitting on the floor and just rocking and saying, my babies, they've killed my babies. Somebody's killed my babies.
David sent his uncles to tell Kim's parents, Janice and Frank Wren.
Janice, late at night, the doorbell rings. What can this be, huh?
Well, it can't be good. So I go out and I open the door and I see him standing out there. And I think my mind just went blank.
And Janice yelled for me to get out there. So I got out there, and Sam said, got some bad news. Kim, Brad, and Jill have been shot. With that, I just kind of slid down to sitting position. I sat there and cried and couldn't believe it.
On Lockhart Road, the sound of sirens, followed by flashing lights. A homicide investigation was beginning, and David's friends and former colleagues in the Indiana State Police would be on the front line. Something strange at the crime scene. Kim's shoes placed neatly on top of the Bronco. What could that mean?
Never seen her take her shoes off. Never.
You saw the shoes up.
Damn straight, I did.
A mother, son, and daughter gunned down in the garage of the family home in a quiet Indiana county. The two kids never made it out of the back seat of the Bronco. Who murdered them? The answer to that question would be the responsibility of the investigators, the Indiana State Police, and the Floyd County prosecutor in southern Indiana, Stan Faith. He got the call at 10:30 that night.
Did someone from the other end of the phone tell you it's bad? Prepare yourself.
It was horrible. Yeah.
Faith knew immediately that the case would be big. He got to the crime scene ASAP. The first thing the prosecutor noticed was the ribbon of blood running out of the garage right down the drive.
I almost stepped in it myself.
He could see the wife and mother, Kim Cam, lying by the open passenger door, her pants removed. It had the signature of a sex crime, the children killed because they were witnesses. 7-year-old Brad was on his back, a gray sweatshirt lying by him, an article of clothing that would become hugely important in time.
The boy was laying there, his hands were out, and of course I didn't see the little girl, and they told me that she was still in the truck.
The state police, Indiana's top investigative force, had already begun its work. The crime scene techs examined the Bronco, took their measurements and their pictures, and Stan Faith studied the scene.
Was there anything odd, or was it soon for you to take all that stuff in?
No. The thing that struck me the most was how clean the garage was. You just don't expect that.
Some of the troopers in the garage had been fellow officers of the husband, David Cam.
There were a couple that I didn't really recognize, but for the most part, throughout the course of the evening, they would be people that I knew.
The trooper who would become the lead investigator was David's childhood friend. They had the talk right there.
Dave, you know we got to clear you first. And I kept saying, just do it right. I said that repeatedly.
As a former cop, David Cam knew the score about spouses.
You knew because of your experience, they always look at the spouse.
Sure, you know, everybody's a suspect. In the beginning, you don't know.
But in his case, David thought it was a by-the-book formality. He was confident his friends would do all they could to find the killer.
These were your brothers in uniform, these guys.
Right.
You'd ridden with them.
I hadn't been to their
You'd done
homes.
A lot of tough stuff with them.
They'd been to my house. We had eaten together. We knew each other's families.
I'm here at the Indiana State Police Post, and also present is David Cam.
In this audio tape of his first interview that night, you can hear the troopers handling him with kid gloves out of respect.
We're going to try and find out what happened here so we can let that person to justice as best we know how.
Do it right.
Right, so exactly.
That's for everyone asking.
The questioner walked David through his day and his wife's. As far as David knew, she'd followed her usual busy routine, working, then shepherding the kids around after school, returning home about 7:30 p.m. Was the shooter waiting for her in the garage, or did her killer follow her in? The investigators asked David if anyone had been stalking Kim, bothering her.
There is. She hasn't said a word. About phone calls? Hang up phone calls, suspicious phone calls.
And they wanted to know if the husband could help them understand an oddity about the crime scene. Why would Kim's shoes have ended up neatly placed atop the roof of the Bronco?
I have no idea where all the shoes are set up.
Does she ever take her, kick her shoes off when she's driving?
Never seen her take her shoes off. Never.
You saw those shoes though?
Damn straight I did.
As the investigators wrapped up, they made sure David got some fresh clothing because they were sending his blood-speckled sneakers and T-shirt out for testing.
We'll do everything we can, work as hard as we can, to resolve this.
The next day, the Cam's neighbors were absolutely stunned by a crime of this magnitude in their quiet community.
It makes no sense. You know, they've never been in trouble out here to speak of, you know.
As the hunt for the killer continued, investigators asked neighbors if they'd seen or heard anything suspicious.
Right now, this is very, very much an open investigation.
3 days after the murders, David Camp faced the cameras.
I want my family back. I want my babies back. I want my wife.
And he begged the killer to come forward.
Turn yourself in. You can't live with the guilt. What you did was such a irrational, ridiculous, ludicrous, satanic thing. You cannot live with that guilt.
An arrest in the case was only hours away.
I'm a mess. I'm on medication. I'm having to buy caskets. I'm having to buy burial plots.
A husband and father in mourning, about to face the second biggest surprise of his life.
You're not right. You're wrong. You're wrong, wrong, wrong.
In the days after the murders, two families, the Lockharts, uncles, aunts, nephews, nieces, and Kim's family were united in grief.
We lost three wonderful people that we loved dearly. We don't have them with us today.
Kim, Bradley, Jill, just like that, gone.
All gone.
David was all but shutting down.
I'm a mess. I'm on medication. You know, I'm having to buy caskets. I'm having to buy burial plots. You know, I've got all this stuff going on.
3 days after the murders, the Indiana State Police called David in for a second interview. He sat down with two cops he knew well. He'd been sharing coffee and cases with them for years.
Because of the high profile of this case, and because of, obviously, as you know well, no writer, we're doing this all by the numbers.
This time, the tone of the interview had changed, because now the investigators did have a working theory of the murders. And the evidence they were gathering pointed to none other than David Kam as the killer. Their one-time fellow trooper, their law enforcement brother, was now quite possibly their man, a monster who had murdered his family. They had a timeline. The murders took place, they believed, between 9:15 and 9:30 that night, after David returned home.
People heard something they thought was unusual when we talked to them. They said, sounded like gunfire.
The police canvas had turned up a neighbor who heard noises, maybe shots fired.
They know the time. The time was when you were already home.
Which was?
Around 9:20, shortly thereafter.
David saw where this was going and pushed back.
And this is just facts. I'm just telling you what we, you know.
It's wrong.
Are these people making up this time?
I'm telling you, people are confused. The time element is off.
The investigator's account had David Kam square in the crosshairs. He came home from basketball and killed his family.
It's not right. It's not right. It's not right, guys. You're not right. You're wrong. You're wrong, wrong, wrong. You're wrong, Daryl. You're wrong.
Well,
this is not right. You're getting off the track. Something's not right here. Now fix it.
They told David about physical evidence they'd collected. Specks of blood, barely visible to the naked eye, on the bottom of the t-shirt he wore that night. A crime scene expert, Science, had already told them the husband and father did it.
There's blood on your shirt, and they'll have a DNA analyzed. This is the presumptive test that it is high-velocity blood spatter. It's scientific documentation. The only way that comes on is from blowback or blowout from a gunshot wound.
Blood spatter, the case against David Kam.
That is supposed to be on my t-shirt that I play ball in.
It's on you.
It's wrong, Daryl.
Dave,
wrong, guys.
What do we do when they tell us that? Now we gotta figure out why.
We better find another expert.
But the cops had full confidence in their man.
I rely on this man. And he's very, he's renowned as far as his expertise. This is not something he just started to do yesterday.
The noose was tightening even as David protested.
The t-shirt that I had on was what I had on. That's what I wore over, and that's what I wore home. And any blood that's got on it now came from either an impression of something I leaned on in the car, or it came off of Brad himself.
And there was more. Signs of a cleanup. That had to be David.
She cleaned this, tried to clean this up. Tried to clean some of the blood up or something like that.
No. This is ridiculous.
What about some bleach stain?
No. I didn't clean up. Somebody may have,
that it wasn't me. That person is your suspect.
And there was something disturbing the medical examiner found when she looked at Jill, the young daughter. Signs of blunt trauma in the genital area. To the cops, that meant one thing. David Kahn had molested his daughter.
She was molested. It happened that day, that night. That's when it happened. And it wasn't by me. You guys are wrong here. You're wrong, Mickey. I did not do this. I did not do this.
You did do it.
I don't know. That's why I called you guys. That's what your job, that's what you're supposed to be doing. You're looking so hard at me.
We look at everybody, Dave, but honestly.
But Mickey, you're so off base. You're so wrong. You're so wrong, Mickey.
An arrest warrant issued out of Floyd Superior Court.
Hours after his second interview, the Indiana State Police arrested David Kahn and charged him with the murders of his wife and two children. It had been 3 days since the shootings. Accused of murder. And the evidence? A phone call. This phone call blows up his alibi.
Yes.
A t-shirt. And a parade of women.
There's people he pulls over, flirts with them, and eventually seduces them.
Baby's back. My wife.
David Kahn, once an Indiana State Trooper, was now locked up in the Floyd County Jail, charged with the murder of his wife and children.
Tell me about your emotions.
Every time I heard a key jingle outside my door, I would think to myself, oh, this is it. They've figured it out, and they're going to come let me out and say, Dave, we messed up.
But that never happened. David's uncle and boss, Sam Lockhart, a successful local businessman, quickly became his nephew's most passionate advocate. Sam had the grit to make his voice heard.
Why did you take on the responsibility, Sam, to take it as far as you could?
I didn't have any other options. I know he's innocent. I know he lost his family. And I know he's lost his freedom. And what am I going to do? He didn't lose me.
The focus was so concentrated on David. Did you ever think, well, maybe I don't have the picture here. Maybe something awful happened and David snapped and did indeed kill his family.
Well, I never did think Dave killed his family. Never.
You never?
Never thought it. Never did.
Kim's parents, Janice and Frank Wren, mourning the loss of their daughter and grandchildren, were absorbing the awful facts the police told them, that their son-in-law was the killer.
Janice, they've made an arrest.
Mm-hmm.
And it's David.
I was just out of it. Then when it finally did sink in, I was back and forth.
Frank, how about you? What were you? We're talking about early days here.
Yeah, I wasn't 100% sure. I mean, I just went by what the police was telling me.
Before long, the Wrens became convinced that their son-in-law had murdered his family. In January 2002, 15 months after the murders, David Kahn went on trial. He pleaded not guilty. By now, the prosecutor's timeline had changed. Originally, he said David killed his family between 9:15 and 9:30 after he returned home from the basketball game.
And then you backtracked from that.
We backtracked from that.
That's because the defense had shown that the time of death was somewhere between 7:30 and 8 p.m.
Everything said that this happened much earlier.
Now, the prosecutor argued, David went to the gym about 7 o'clock, then secretly ducked out of the basketball game, made the 5-minute drive home, killed his family, and returned to play ball. And the prosecutor had proof that David was home at the time of the murders. There was a call to a customer from his landline phone, time-stamped 7:19 p.m.
So you got a husband who says, I was playing basketball at 7. You got a phone record that says he likely is making a call to a customer landline in his home, so he's not playing basketball.
Almost certainly would be the one that was doing it.
And that this phone call blows up his alibi.
Yes.
The prosecutor moved on to the crime scene and focused on what happened to Kim in the garage that night.
We thought the pants had been pulled down.
You've accused the husband of the murder. Why are you telling the jury that he probably pulled her pants down?
As part of a staged event.
Kim had not been raped. But the prosecutor argued her body appeared to have been moved, staged, and a cop would know how to do it.
Trying to get the jury to think that somebody was in there to molest her.
That there'd been a break-in guy, huh?
Yeah.
Investigators had never located the murder weapon, The only physical evidence the state had that the gun was in David Kam's hand that night was this. Barely visible microscopic droplets of his daughter's blood on the lower left hem of Kam's t-shirt. How those drops of blood got there was the crux of the case.
Blowback. This is what happens when you shoot somebody at close range.
Yes.
You get that blood on your shirt.
Correct. If you got high velocity impact spatter on his t-shirt, he has to be within 4 feet of the child at the time that the child was killed.
The prosecution believed David Kam shot from inside the car, targeting Jill in the back seat. That's how her blood sprayed on his shirt. But why? Why would David Kam kill his family? The reason for those killings, the prosecutor declared, was that David Kam was a philandering husband.
It probably was one of the first times that I really ever heard Kim cry.
Remember Kim's old friend, Marcy McLeod? The prosecutor had her testify about an affair David had when Kim was pregnant in late 1994. Marcy told the court Kim called her in tears to say she and David were separating. Soon after, Marcy visited Kim.
She was upset, and saddened by it, especially just having a baby.
And there was more. Just 3 weeks before the murders, Marcy had another troubling phone call from Kim.
Her demeanor was different, her attitude, and she didn't want to hang up the phone, but yet she didn't want to talk.
The old friends made plans for Kim and the children to visit Marcy. Then Kim said something she never explained.
She felt like history was repeating itself. We didn't go into what that meant because she said, well, I'll talk about it when I get there.
Kim never made it. At trial, the clear implication was that David Kam was catting around again. The prosecutor portrayed him as a scoundrel who used his badge to get sex.
There's people he pulls over, flirts with them, and eventually seduces them.
In court, the prosecutor called a parade of women, presenting them as David Kam's conquests. More than a dozen of them recounting the fondling, the flirting, the sex, the stripper in the patrol car.
He wanted to have women, and his wife was getting in the way.
Yes.
That she was an obstacle for the kind of lifestyle that he wanted to pursue.
Huh? That's correct.
And if the dalliances with the women weren't enough to suggest motivation to the jury, the prosecutor had a capper, something really dreadful. The medical examiner's testimony that injuries observed on the murdered daughter, 5-year-old Jill, were consistent with sexual abuse.
So not a little girl falling on the monkey bars?
No, it wasn't monkey bars. Wasn't a bicycle. Anything like that.
So there was the prosecution's accused. Womanizer, child molester, the killer with blowback blood spatter on his t-shirt. The defense lawyers had their work cut out for them.
You had an uphill fight as the defense attorney.
Oh, yes, sir. Yes, and that's not unusual, but this one was just so much more high profile.
The timeline of the crime.
That was their smoking gun.
The defense is about to stop the clock. The trial of David Kam was underway in Floyd County, Indiana. It was the winter of 2002.
Nervous to see that those men and women want to sign your fate?
David Kam, accused of murdering his wife and two young children, always insisted the case against him was built on quicksand.
It's about them crafting and molding a belief that was totally founded on things that weren't factual, and it was just a complete fiction.
David's defense attorney was Mike McDaniel, now deceased. He told us he had known David as a trooper.
What impressions did you have of David before he became the client?
I figured he was another redneck state cop. We'd done a couple of cases, him on one side, me on the other.
But McDaniel became convinced of David's innocence and came on board to defend him.
This is one of those terrible cases that a defense lawyer never wants. You don't want an innocent client. You call them a ravager because they make you crazy.
At trial, McDaniel knew he had to confront all those women, but how? The defense could only flinch and take the body blows to Cam's character.
The jury's getting a picture of this hard-working wife, nose to the grindstone, taking care of the babies, running the household.
Yep.
While he's out with pole dancers.
Yep. On duty. You got 13 women coming in there with varying degrees of sexual contact or innuendo. Another trooper's wife, for God's sakes.
Not a good set of facts.
Not a good set of facts.
The defense pulled out potentially its strongest weapon and put David on the stand to say he knew that he'd messed up.
You know, I regret all of that stuff. It's so unfortunate, the disrespect that I showed my wife. But good God, we don't jump from that to saying that automatically makes a person a murderer. It's just ridiculous.
Then the defense had to confront the ugly allegation that 5-year-old Jill Cam had been molested. But in fact, the medical examiner's report had not actually said that. It simply stated the girl's bruises were the result of blunt trauma. The defense argued the bruises happened during the attack. Still, it was tough going.
We've got a guy who seems to have a lot of girlfriends. There may be some evidence here of child molestation. This is a very, very tough thing to combat, Dave.
It is. It's virtually impossible.
Having done its best to hammer the state's case for motive, the defense turned to the physical evidence. The state's strongest evidence, the forensic case for David's guilt, was the blood spatter. A defense expert testified the blood got on David's t-shirt very simply. When David reached into the back seat to move his son, his shirt brushed against his daughter's hair.
There were tiny droplets of blood on some of her hair around the wound. So defense testimony was that was transfer from that contact with the ends of the strands of her hair.
And then the timeline. The defense lawyer challenged the prosecution's theory that David snuck out in the middle of his basketball game, killed his family, and then returned to play ball. The defense attorney focused on the phone call made from the Cam house at 7:19 p.m. when David said he was at the church gym. The state had tethered its timeline to that phone call.
That was their smoking gun, which they had a bunch of those, and every time they have a smoking gun, we just unload it.
The defense unloaded by calling a witness from Verizon, who testified that its timestamp was incorrect because of Indiana's jumbled time zones.
So their 7:19 phone call actually was my 6:19 phone call.
A call David made to a client before he left to play ball. And even more important, David had a solid alibi. 11 eyewitnesses, the basketball players, to corroborate his story that he'd been at the gym throughout the early evening.
Did he leave the court that night?
No.
He couldn't have left without one of you guys.
Without one of them, because I would see him at one point in time running down the court. And then maybe Jeff would have saw him at another point in time. So throughout that time, there's 10 sets of eyes looking in different directions. As a group, I think someone would have noticed that he was missing.
Sam Lockhart, the uncle, was playing ball that night too.
Sam, the basketball game, is it possible Dave could have slipped away?
Is it possible that he snuck out, was gone 10 or 15 minutes, killed his family, and snuck back in without any one of us noticing it? Absolutely not. That's impossible.
But if David wasn't the killer, then who was? The defense had its answer. It was the person who owned that gray sweatshirt, the one that was lying by Brad's body on the garage floor the night of the murders. Defense attorney Mike McDaniel had recognized the sweatshirt as prison issue.
In the collar of the sweatshirt is the word backbone. And I'm thinking, okay, that's a nickname.
Tests on that sweatshirt revealed DNA from various people, including an unknown male. But the prosecutor said there was no match when that male DNA was run through the national database. Still, it seemed to be a breakthrough for Team David, proof that someone else was in the garage that night.
We knew that that was probably the key to solving this. Now, we didn't know that person by name. By God, we knew him by DNA profile.
Finally, it was up to the jurors. As reporters lingered in the hallway, the jury deliberated for 3 days.
Guilty.
David Cam was found guilty of killing his wife and children.
Frank, the jury comes back and guilty as charged.
Yeah, that's what we wanted. And now we feel like, you know, we can, Kim and Brad Jill, they can be at rest now.
But from David's sister, an emotional outburst.
Before I even knew it, I was standing up and I was screaming, "You're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong." And a few people had to take me out of the courtroom.
And you're being walked off in chains. You're not leaving that courthouse.
Right. And knowing what lies ahead of me, you know, going to prison, a former police officer. But there's absolutely nothing I can do about it.
David Cam was sent to the state penitentiary to serve a term of 195 years. But his Uncle Sam was hanging in.
You didn't think you were finished at that point?
Unless they had killed me. That's how they could have stopped me. They could have killed me. No, it wasn't over.
It wasn't over, not by a long shot. But not even Uncle Sam could predict the stunning turn that lay ahead. A break in the case. Someone new enters the picture.
As brainy as Ted Bundy and as brawny as Mike Tyson, he's a sociopath.
Who is this guy? In early 2002, David Kam was found guilty on three counts of murdering his wife and two children. His sentence, 195 years behind bars.
You've been sent to the slammer that you're going to do time in?
Right. Yeah, ultimately.
You're learning how to become incarcerated.
I had to. I didn't have a choice. I had to figure out how to survive. And I made my mind up early on. That's what I was going to do, whatever it took.
Did you get confronted inside the joint? This is the guy that was a former cop, trooper?
And not directly, but people would say things or you would hear people talking and so on.
Did you think I'm done?
You know what? I was just bewildered at first, but I didn't know that there was still a possibility or some glimmer of hope that there's this thing called an appeal.
A successful appeal, another trial. Most convicts cling futilely to that straw.
Overturning a first-degree murder conviction, long odds.
Yes, until you read that transcript.
A new team of attorneys, Kitty Lyle and Stacy Uliana, took the case to the State Court of Appeals.
And then it wasn't long odds, in my mind. I mean, because it was way over the top.
What was over the top, they argued, was allowing all those women to testify to the sex, the groping, the come-ons.
I mean, it was weeks after weeks, woman after woman.
How is that relevant to what happened on September 28th?
Jurors, this is a bad guy we've got here.
Absolutely.
He's a louse of a husband. Mm-hmm. And we're going to tell you more than that.
That was intentional, too.
And guess what? 2 years after the guilty verdict, the appeals court agreed. The women should never have been permitted to testify. The conviction was overturned. But the victory was short-lived. A new prosecutor announced there would be a second trial.
After review of the previous evidence and review of some new evidence that has come to light, I've decided to pursue the charges against David Kam for the murders of Kimberly Kam, Bradley Kam, and Jill Kam.
With another trial looming, the defense team was intent on bringing sharply into focus a piece of evidence it believed would set David free. The gray sweatshirt with that unknown male DNA. Back in 2001, the prosecutor said there'd been no match when the DNA was run through a national criminal database. But Sam Lockhart says he approached the new investigators to run it through again.
They weren't even wanting to talk to me. I wanted to show them the unknown DNA. I said, in case that this guy had been arrested now and you got new DNA on this databank, would you run this? No, we can't take it.
Then the attorneys tried. They asked the prosecutor.
We start saying, please run the DNA through the databank. Please do it. And he refuses.
The state finally ran the DNA 3 months after Sam Lockhart first started asking about it.
And lo and behold, we find Charles Bonet.
Charles Bonet, does this name mean anything to you?
Didn't mean a thing. I'd never heard the name before. It was a complete shock to me.
Charles Bonet, a name that would change everything in the case against David Kam. Bonet, his prison nickname was Backbone. The same name inked in on the sweatshirt's collar.
Who does this guy Bonet turn out to be?
As brainy as Ted Bundy and as brawny as Mike Tyson. He's a sociopath.
Charles Bonet, a criminal with a history of violent crimes against women. It began in the 1980s when he was a student at Indiana University. Newspapers called him the Shoe Bandit and followed his bizarre crimes. There had been four separate incidents. His early M.O., he'd knock a woman to the ground and make off with one of her shoes.
Really creepy stuff. Like one crime, he wore one of those China doll masks. I mean, like creepy stuff you can't make up.
The police were onto him. After one arrest, he admitted, in effect, that he had a thing for ladies' legs and feet. He pleaded guilty to those crimes. And in time, his attacks became more violent. He began threatening women at gunpoint. One incident involved three co-eds.
He had been watching them and one night just walked into their apartment, held them at gunpoint to their head, took them out, kidnapped them to the car. Luckily, somebody saw him with the gun leading the women out, called Bloomington Police Department.
He pleaded guilty again and was sentenced to 20 years in prison for armed robbery, but was released after serving only 7 years. By July 2000, 3 months before the Cam murders, he was out on parole. And the defense maintains he still had the old compulsion.
Kim Cam fit the profile.
Yes, he has a foot fetish. And so when they thought at first that it was not a sex crime, we kept saying, well, not everybody targets the same place in sex crimes.
Kim Cam had bruising on her toes. Her shoes were on top of the Bronco. Her pants had been removed. And Bonet's sweatshirt with his DNA was at the crime scene. And it turns out that DNA had been in the database 3 years before the murders.
It took 1 hour and one email to find Charles Bonet. That could have been done in 2002 had Prosecutor Faith done it.
And you'd think on a case in which, you know, children and a mom are murdered, ambushed in a garage, that they would bend over backwards to do it right.
Stan Faith was the prosecutor in trial one.
The defense said, well, we asked you, the state, the prosecutors, to send that out to be balanced, to be tested against a national register of DNA. And
I asked the lead investigator to do that. And he said we didn't get anything. And that's
But
what
in
I
fact,
thought.
He hadn't sent it out at all.
No, I think he sent it out. He hadn't sent the proper DNA.
Faith says he later learned the detective sent out the wrong DNA sample from the sweatshirt. Mike McDaniel, David's first defense attorney, didn't buy that.
I think he's a liar.
You don't think he ever ran it?
No, I don't think he ever asked anybody to run it.
He told you he did?
Yes.
So when he says that the prosecution is lying to him?
Lying means that you knowingly, you tell a falsehood. I didn't tell him a lie. I told him what I thought was true.
But whatever the truth is, now more than 4 years later, there was a name to that DNA.
Do you allow yourself to think, here we are on our way to case closed, finally?
Absolutely.
We've got a name, sure. We've got genetic forensic evidence. This is the shooter, right. This is the killer.
Absolutely.
A new suspect in the hot seat.
If anything else links you to it, you're done. Stick a fork in you. And see, that would normally worry me. I wasn't there.
This intense interrogation, where will it lead? By 2005, David Cam had been behind bars for more than 4 years.
Generally from September through February were my darkest times of the year. You know, the times of the murders, and then you have the holidays and then the kids' birthdays in February.
Did you feel yourself becoming institutionalized?
I had to a degree. And for me, it was a matter of, you know, sitting back and observing and seeing how things operate so that I could fit in enough, you know, to be okay. You know, I had to lock the real me down inside.
How were his spirits, Julie? Was he holding on or was he sinking?
Dave would sink only briefly. He would have lows. There'd be times when I'd talk to him and he'd sound really down, but he never stayed there because he couldn't stay there. Staying in that despondency, that hopelessness is excruciating.
But now there finally seemed to be a break in the case. The unknown male DNA on the sweatshirt had been identified as Charles Bonet's. And just 2 days later, the cops brought Bonet in and started grilling him on how it ended up on the garage floor.
That sweatshirt is in the middle of a crime scene of a triple homicide. Somehow that sweatshirt got there, your sweatshirt. You explain to me how it got there. I have no idea.
Bonet admitted the sweatshirt had once been his, but said he dumped it in a Salvation Army drop box about a month before the murders.
It shows up at a crime scene, not laundered, not washed. If it had went through the Salvation Army drop box, that would have been a clean sweatshirt. Your DNA, chances are, probably wouldn't have been on there. But it is. I see where you're coming from.
As for David Kam.
You know David Kam?
No.
You ever met David Kam?
No.
Do you remember the murder of David Kam's family?
On television, yes.
Do you know where David Kam lives?
Only on television. I don't even know what his address is.
The interrogation went on for some 12 hours with Bonet sticking to his story. The detectives released him with a warning.
Make no mistake about it. If anything else links you to it, you're done. Stick a fork in you.
And see, that would normally worry me. I wasn't there.
Then 2 weeks after letting Bonet walk, there was something else, something big.
Early yesterday morning, I was notified of some additional scientific evidence that linked Mr. Bonet to the homicides.
The prosecutor revealed that a palm print found on the exterior passenger side of the Bronco doorframe was left there by none other than Charles Bonet. Investigators had been aware of the palm print for more than 4 years. Only now did they know whose it was. Bonet was hauled back into the interrogation room, and the questioning became more confrontational.
You got some explaining to do here, Charles. Your palm print is on that Bronco. You're there. Now, this is the time, this is the place, this is your last stage that you're going to have to tell us what the hell happened there. This is it.
This can't be happening.
Charles!
After hours of denial, Bonet changed his story. Yes, he did know David Kam. They met playing pickup basketball. Then, in another round of questioning, the story changed and changed again. Finally, Bonet put himself at the crime scene.
The reason why I was there was to bring him that night.
Bonet said David Kam asked him to get an untraceable gun. He said that he was a guy caught in the wrong place at the wrong time.
As events started to unfold in the investigation, it became apparent that this case was intertwined between two people.
Now the prosecutor had a new theory. David Kam did not act alone. He had a co-conspirator. The ex-cop and the ex-con were each charged with the three killings. David was outraged. He believed he should have been set free. After all, Charles Bonet's signature was all over the scene.
He attacks women, defenseless, innocent women. He takes their shoes, their socks. He holds guns to their heads and threatens to shoot them in the head. You know, all of those things from his previous crimes is exactly what happened to Kim. Why can't they see this stuff? You know, they just turn a blind eye to the facts.
But the prosecutor had a different set of facts.
We know that the defense has maintained that this is now the killer, that I should dismiss the charges against David Kam. The evidence is not there.
In January 2006, Charles Bonet and David Kam stood trial separately in two different courthouses. While he wasn't accused of being the shooter, Bonet was found guilty on three counts of murder in the deaths of Kim, Brad, and Jill Kam. He was sentenced to 225 years. And the prosecution team rejected any notion that Bonet acted alone. Why? Those tiny specks of blood, they were on David's shirt, but not on Bonet's sweatshirt.
His shirt does not have high-velocity blood spatter on it.
So a former Indiana State trooper is now going to be a co-conspirator with a felon.
That makes sense. His story is the only thing you've got that link him to David Kam. There's no phone records. There's no one's ever seen them together. There's no text messages. There's no smoke signals. There's nothing between David Kam and Charles Bonet.
At David Kam's second trial, Bonet was named as the other man at the scene, also charged with the triple murders. Otherwise, the case against Kam was pretty much the same, absent the female witnesses the appeals court had thrown out. This time, the state focused on the allegation that David molested his 5-year-old daughter as a motive for the murders.
Well, the motive was Kimberly was leaving David Kam, and that she was leaving him because of the child molesting. And he could not let her leave. He could not let that secret out. That was the secret in the Kam household.
The defense countered, brought in experts to show there was no solid evidence the little girl had even been molested.
The state's theory of why David murdered his family was purely made up. It was speculation.
David Kam had never been charged with sexual molestation, but that didn't stop the prosecutor from closing his case with a big dramatic flourish.
He took his finger and stuck it in Dave's face and said, "You molested your child."
The jury took 4 days to reach its verdict.
Guilty on all three counts, we can tell you that David Kam has now been convicted of the murder of his wife and the murder of his two kids, Brad and Jill.
Guilty again.
Guilty again. With the same inflammatory evidence, this is just such a heinous accusation.
But the saga was far from over. David Kam's uncle still refused to retreat.
So you go to Dave and you say, "We tried."
Yeah, I say, "We're not done, dude. You gotta hang in there. We're not done."
They certainly weren't done, but prosecutors weren't done either.
The placement of the sweatshirt led you to believe that David Kam put it there.
And Charles Bonet, he was just getting started.
He wants me to deliver a second handgun.
Sam Lockhart's mission to clear the name of his nephew David continued unabated after Kam and Charles Bonet were both convicted of the murders of David's family.
Now we've got the killer who killed Kim, Brad, and Jill. We finally got that accomplished. Now, our next chore, we're still after that. We were still after getting Dave Kam another trial.
You're back to the appeals court again.
Right.
The Indiana Supreme Court heard the appeal. Attorneys Stacy Uliana and Kitty Lyle stayed on the case.
These crimes are also connected to...
They argued that the evidence that David molested his daughter was pure speculation and should not have been allowed in the trial.
There's absolutely no evidence at all that Kam was the perpetrator of that, right?
In 2009, the upper court agreed.
Convictions reversed. Two words. That's all I needed.
A second victory for the Kam team. The conviction was overturned, and the judges ordered a new trial.
Statistically, a successful appeal of a first-degree murder charge is a long shot, and yet you got it.
Well, I got it twice. That doesn't happen. Doesn't happen. You know, if you don't believe in something bigger, you need to really evaluate your spirituality because, you know, man, that was a God thing.
The third David Kam murder trial underway now in Boone County,
Indiana. August 2013, more than a dozen years after the murders, David Kam faced his third jury. A special prosecutor, Stan Lepko, was appointed to represent the state.
Here you're going to start the third trial. How did you appraise your case when it became yours?
When I first got it, it was just overwhelming. I've tried a lot of cases over the years, a lot of death penalty cases, murder cases. I've never tried anything like this. I've never seen anything this complicated.
With no philandering husband, no molesting father, what remained was the theory of the crime that David left the basketball game, killed his family, then went back to play some more. Once again, the prosecutor argued that the scene in the garage was staged to look like a sex crime.
And her pants had been removed.
Correct.
Removed after she'd been killed. What's more, the positioning of Kim's body, he argued, was not what you'd expect of a person who'd been shot and fallen.
Her feet are under the car, about roughly 10, 12 inches under the car. Her legs were at an angle, which seemed unusual.
Unusual how?
They weren't straight. They were at an angle. You just wouldn't expect them to be that way.
And the infamous sweatshirt, the one that once belonged to Charles Bonet, was also part of the staging, the prosecutor argued.
The placement of the sweatshirt was incriminating. I thought the way it was put there led you to believe that David Kam put it there.
Tucked all too neatly under Brad Kam's body, as though put there on purpose to frame Charles Bonet. Remember, no murder weapon was ever found. The heart of the prosecution's case was still that freckling of blood at the bottom of David's shirt. Powerful, incriminating evidence, it argued, marking David as the shooter.
The little girl was seatbelted on this side as you're looking in.
Tom Bevel, a bloodstain pattern analyst, was an expert witness for the prosecution. In a Bronco similar to the one owned by the Cams, he demonstrated for us where he believes David was wedged inside the car to get those specks of blood on the bottom of his shirt.
What's a likely posture for the shooter? Would have been leaned in somewhat like this in order to get the correct trajectory for her.
Now, I noticed your shooting hand is up pretty high.
It is.
Is that an awkward shot?
It's not necessarily awkward, but we have to go with the physical evidence, and the physical evidence isn't like this.
But why so few spots? Bevel said it's because most of the blowback hit the inside roof of the vehicle. Like much of the other evidence, the blood spatter testimony was essentially the same as in the other two trials. What would be enormously different this time was the star witness. The jury was going to hear from Charles Bonnet himself. A huge risk for Prosecutor Levko.
So you got to wonder how good this witness Bonnet is going to be for you, right?
Yes. Certainly his credibility was going to be in question.
Why put him on the stand then?
I felt like I didn't have a choice. If I didn't put him on the stand, I suspect they would have. But also, I thought the jury ought to hear it.
This is the story Bonnet told in court. He said he met David Kam in July 2000 playing basketball in a local park. We talked to Bonnet in prison.
It was just a pickup game of basketball, and I didn't know him or really anyone there. I'm fresh out of prison. You know, the scene is different.
After the game, he said Kam was bragging, talking smack about how easily he'd beaten Bonnet.
At that point, I just said, well, you know, I may have lost the game, but at least I have my freedom. And he's like, freedom? I was like, yeah, I just got out of prison.
Kam, Bonnet continued, then told him he used to be a state trooper.
At the end of that day, did you know him by name?
No, I didn't know his full name until our second chance meeting.
That meeting was in September, Bonnet said, about a week or so before the murders. They ran into each other at a convenience store and got to talking in the parking lot.
The gist of our conversation was about, are you employed? Were you staying out of trouble? And then it evolved into, well, what types of things did you do to get in prison in the first place? He was creating his own form of intel. He was learning quite a few things about Charles Bonnet.
Bonnet told him he'd been inside for robbery.
When I slowly started to let him know about some of the things that I did in the past, he asked me, well, are you still able to get untraceable weapons?
Untraceable?
That's what it led to. I'm just...
A clean gun.
A clean gun.
A throwdown gun.
Something that can't be traced by law enforcement and ballistics.
So Bonnet said he scored a handgun the same day, met David again in a parking lot, and handed over the weapon. He paid Bonnet $250. But one gun wasn't enough, as Bonet's story goes.
He wants me to deliver yet a second handgun. And so I followed Mr. Kam back to his house. I can see visibly exactly where he lives.
As Bonnet tells it, they spoke outside the house for just 5 minutes. Bonnet asked when he should return with the second gun.
And I'm asking this man, you know, what time? What time should I be back here? Well, why don't you come back on Thursday at approximately 7 o'clock, etc. So I knew what time to be back.
So meet me here on Thursday night in the evening, and you'll have some more cash in your pocket.
Absolutely.
It was Thursday, September 28th, the evening of the murders.
I arrived at Mr. Cam's house at approximately 7 o'clock.
He said he handed over the gun to Kam wrapped in his gray sweatshirt.
Where's this happening?
Right outside the garage. So we exchanged pleasantries, and my sole purpose is to simply get the $250 for the second weapon.
Bonnet says after a few minutes, the Bronco with the wife and kids arrived and pulled into the garage.
And what happens?
I hear a little bit of commotion. It just sounds like something's not right. It sounds like they're arguing. And then all of a sudden, I hear an immediate pop. And before I heard the pop, I heard her say no. And it was a commanding no, like stop. And then I heard a pop. Then I heard the word daddy.
Two more pops followed.
Did you know what that was?
It sounded like handgun.
So what'd you think?
I'm thinking that this is a crime scene.
So do you say I gotta get out of here?
I would have liked to have just left, but as he emerged from the garage and pointed the handgun at me, I was frozen.
Oh, so now you're a target.
Absolutely. So he needs to kill Charles Bonnet.
But the gun jammed.
At that point, reason says, I'm out of here.
Well, the thing is, once I realize that your gun doesn't have projectiles in it, now my job is to get you.
You're going for him.
Absolutely.
Now, as Bonnet tells it, the scene moved into the garage.
As I go into the garage, I'm chasing after Mr. Cam. I heard him say, "You did this." And I took that as, "This is your crime."
As Cam went inside the house, Bonet says he saw the victims, the wife down by the car door. He remembers her being fully clothed. Then he says he stumbled.
I trip over shoes. I remember touching these shoes. I clearly touched something that is now a part of what will be a murder scene. So yeah, I did pick them up. I did try to wipe them off.
Kim's shoes, he placed them on top of the Bronco. Then he looked inside the vehicle and says he saw the two children. Mindful of leaving DNA and prints, he says he touched none of the bodies. Then he says he heard David moving inside the house.
And it clicked into my head, he's going for a weapon. I mean, this guy is a former Indiana State Trooper.
At which point he bolted from the scene.
Had I stayed there any longer, there's no doubt he would have killed me and he would have just lied and said to his buddies at the Indiana State Police, "I came home and I found this black guy."
After listening to Bonet testify, the defense was ready to pounce.
That's his story, and it makes absolutely no sense, but it explains away all the evidence that they had against him at the time. But what Bonet didn't account for was the DNA that was going to be found, and he has no story for that.
New DNA evidence.
He absolutely fought with Kim. He touched Jill.
What will Charles Bonet have to say now?
Did you do that? Charles Bonet, did you kill that family?
The case against David Cam, the defense argued, was as preposterous this time around as it was before. Who could possibly buy the prosecution's overly complicated theory that David left the basketball game to kill his family?
There is absolutely no way he could have left that gym. You have to believe that he knew when he was going to get to sit out. He timed it perfectly, so it'd be right at the time he was going to meet Charles Bonet and murder his family. It is beyond belief what he would have had to have put in place in order for this alibi to have worked.
This sounds like a commando synchronize your watches kind of scenario.
It's absurd. There's absolutely no common sense way he could have pulled it off.
And Cam had a solid alibi. 11 men had seen him playing basketball from a little after 7 until about 9:20 that night. There was no one to support any part of the story Bonet had just told.
There is not one shred of evidence that puts those two people together.
Richard Kamen was a new face on the defense team.
And the reason there's nothing there is because it didn't happen.
The defense insisted Bonet was the sole killer in the garage that night, and that back in 2000, investigators ignored evidence pointing to the convicted felon. To make that point, the defense called Damon Fay, a veteran homicide detective who now trains police in how to conduct murder investigations.
I don't like testifying against other cops. I'm very uncomfortable with it.
Fay recited flaw after flaw in the Cam investigation. The most significant, he said, was the handling of the sweatshirt, Bonet's sweatshirt.
When a homicide detective actually gets some physical evidence that's got somebody's name on it and DNA, you hug it. You love it. It is such a rare event. And they thought of it as an artifact.
Which in non-legal terms means move on, forget about it. This
is
nothing.
Right. It would have changed everything. First of all, within 2 weeks tops, they would have had Bonet.
And Fay pointed out other blunders as well. The heavy reliance on the blood-spattered T-shirt.
That is the physical evidence against David Cam.
Of all of the crime scene possibilities, the most misinterpreted is blood spatter. You don't hang the entire case just on the interpretation of blood spatter. You've got to have so much more.
The theory of a staged sex crime, flat out wrong.
They really never probed out the fact that it could be a voyeur or somebody with a panty fetish, or somebody who is just sexually excited at the view of a woman's legs.
Someone, say, who fit the profile of Charles Bonet.
Big problem, because the suspect that they don't know about and won't know for about 5 years has complete personality reflected in that crime scene up to the point of how Kim was found.
And remember, a Bonet palm print had also been found on the Bronco. More evidence the defense said that he was the killer.
So here we have a 90s era Ford Bronco.
Defense expert Eugene Licio, an engineer who reconstructs crime scenes, showed us how the palm print would have been left by the shooter.
It really is just as simple as reaching into the vehicle like this to make a shot for Jill. And then for Bradley, you would lean over a bit more and fire a shot this way.
I noticed that you braced yourself here. And this is where crime scene techs find a palm print.
Yes, they did. They found a palm print up in this particular area. But it makes perfect sense that if you're leaning in, you want to be able to stabilize yourself, especially if you're making a shot.
And now the defense had fresh scientific evidence that Bonet actually put his hands on two of the victims.
Bonet's story, of course, was, I ran in, I did this, I never touched anybody. Clearly not true.
There is something in the field of DNA analysis called touch DNA. Lab experts use human cells to make an identifying hit on a suspect. Touch DNA from Bonet's skin cells was found on Kim Kam's sweater, her underwear, and on her daughter Jill's shirt.
The DNA conclusively proves that he absolutely fought with Kim, that he touched Jill.
And the defense hoped its cross-examination of Bonet would be still more proof. Cam had to steel himself to watch Bonet on the stand.
You're looking at him.
Right. There was no way for me to actually prepare myself for that. And it was a situation where I really had to think about what was at stake and doing what was right in that moment. Having to sit there and look at this guy that I knew killed my family and not react.
The defense said Bonet's story was absurd. For starters, why would an ex-cop ask an ex-con for a gun?
The police officer doesn't think, well, how can I trust this guy? He's a criminal. And the guy who just got out of prison doesn't smell a rat. He doesn't think maybe I'm being set up. It makes absolutely no sense.
The defense took on Bonet's story in cross-examination. We had some of the same questions when we spoke to him.
How many versions did it take to get to the story you just told, Charles? What, three, four, five times maybe?
Yes. I finally realized that the more I keep lying, I'm just digging myself deeper and deeper. I'm not going to get out of it. And when I did finally start telling the truth about things, I didn't feel comfortable revealing too much too soon because I didn't want to be a part of the case to begin with. So once again, I resorted to telling a lot of stories.
The big picture here, Charles, for a lot of people is it sounds like a crock that a felon just out of the slammer would hook up with a recently retired state police officer and do this gun exchange. It just doesn't seem to make sense. It doesn't pass the sniff test.
There's a lot of things about this case that doesn't make sense.
If I were you, I would have alarms going off inside my head. Here you are on probation. How do you know that this former cop is really a former cop and he's not setting you up with a sting?
Although that did cross my mind and I had concerns about it, there was something about him. If you've spent any time with Mr. Cam, he has a way of putting you at ease. He has a way of making you feel like he's legit and everything's okay. And plus, I didn't care what the gun was for.
You've provided this former trooper with weapons. He was on a special weapons team with the Indiana State Police.
He was SWAT.
So theoretically here, this premeditated crime, he's going to trust a handgun that's come off the street that he hasn't checked out. He's just unwrapped it from the sweatshirt and immediately used it for his business.
Well, it was. It was the gun. Those are questions that I can't possibly answer. Why did he want me there at the crime scene? We know why. Because he wanted me to take the blame for all of this.
So as Bonet tells it, the transaction happens. He delivers the gun, hears the gunfire in the garage, and then David Cam tries to shoot him.
Why don't you just belt right out of there?
If you point a weapon at me, even on a prison level, if a guy comes at me with a shank, I'm going to get that shank from him. And then it's my turn. It's that simple. I'm just going to put it out there. I can't get in any trouble. My intent was to kill David Cam that day. You tried to kill me, and now I'm going to kill you. But before I had a chance to kill him, I stumbled across this beautiful woman, dead, lifeless on the ground.
Then Bonet said he stumbled over the woman's shoes and took the time to place them on top of the Bronco.
But then you're down on the floor the way you tell it. You've tripped?
Yeah, I did. I tripped over the shoes.
And then your emotions are going wild. This guy's trying to kill you. You're at a crime scene. You're going to stop. We have to believe that you can say, oh, shoes. I got to put these now on top of the vehicle, Charles. Well, that doesn't make any sense.
No.
Doesn't make any sense.
Here's the thing. I'm wiping the shoes off, and I see one little leg or something hanging out the passenger side. I go to investigate to see if there's anyone else in the back of the vehicle. And when I leaned in to look, I put the shoes on top. I don't even remember doing it.
Doesn't remember doing it, and he says he doesn't know why.
I wasn't thinking about why I did that, but I was cognizant and really thinking about the DNA or possible fingerprints from having tripped and touched those shoes.
But you know, that palm print, Charles, is just where you would brace yourself to lean across to shoot at that little boy.
That's according to a defense expert witnesses. You got to understand, the prosecution has that same evidence. They don't see it that way.
What I'm saying is, if you're so concerned about tidying up, why would you be so clumsy as to leave a big old handprint on the vehicle?
I leaned in to check on the children. What I seen there was horrifying. I'm not worried about that palm print. I didn't even realize I left a palm print. Do you think that if I had known, I wouldn't have taken the time to wipe it off? I wanted to just get out of there.
Did you touch any of the victims, Charles?
No, I did not.
So how does he explain his touch DNA on Kim and Jill Cam's clothes?
I've touched David Cam, we've shook hands, and he handled my sweatshirt. My skin cells are clearly on him, so anything that he touches can be transferred.
While the defense couldn't tell the jury about Bonet's past, the foot fetish, the armed robberies, we knew the record and asked him about it. When people understand your criminal history, the fetishes, what happened in that garage seems to fit your appetites.
Well,
this guy's history just played out on a violent scale that he'd never been through before.
Well, first of all, my history does not consist of killing women, shooting people, period. I've not ever had anything like that in my past. Yes, I've been in possession of handguns. Yes, when I was 20 years old, I did some armed robberies for cash.
Charles, let me put this to you directly. Were you in the garage that night with a gun in your hand, taking control of Kim Cam?
No, sir.
Kid started to cry. I told you to shut up. Shoot the wife when she comes after you.
Richard Cammon's theory is totally wrong. It never happened.
In your panic, forget the sweatshirt. Forget about trophies of the shoes that maybe you were going to take later. But for the first time, this sex fetish itch that you have has gotten totally out of control and you've massacred a family. Did you do that? Charles Bonet, did you kill that family?
No, sir. In fact, that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. A guy with a foot fetish kills an entire family just to satisfy his foot fetish in a place where he's never been before. It never happened.
What are you hoping the jury hears today?
I have no comment, sir.
With Bonet as the wild card, David Cam's third trial came to an end after 9 weeks.
It's over. But right now, let's wait for the verdict.
Would the jurors believe the tale they'd heard? The felon duped into a crime scene by the ex-cop. For the third time in 13 years, his fate was in their hands.
I was scared to death.
Verdict number 3. Would anyone dare predict what this one would be?
Everybody kind of had that same feeling, but none of us had the nerve to utter it.
The jury in David Cam's third trial had the case. For two families, there was nothing to do but wait. The Rangs, Kim's parents, wanted nothing more than to hear the word guilty again. The new evidence had not changed their minds. You believe David killed your daughter and kids?
Yes, I'll never change it.
Why isn't Bonet's presence enough to explain everything that happened in that garage?
It just didn't. There's just too many other things.
There's too many stories being told on both sides. And, you know, I don't believe neither one of them are telling the truth.
You've gotten word that a verdict has been reached.
The jury took 10 hours to reach a verdict.
I said, well, it has to be guilty. I mean, I wasn't expecting anything but guilty.
Prosecutor Stan Levko's glass was half full or better.
I thought we had a decent chance. I thought it could go either way, but I thought the trial went really well.
But Kim's mom was worried.
Yeah, I was scared because 10-week trial and you're only out 10 hours. I had a really bad feeling from the beginning that it was going to be not guilty.
David, in a holding cell, got ready, shaking violently.
I literally could not button my shirt or fix my tie and my collar and so on. Deputies had to help me.
His family, the Lockharts, were heartened by a relatively fast deliberation.
Everybody kind of had that same feeling of, this might be good. but none of us had the nerve to utter it, you know, because you don't want to say that, because the hurt, the pain when they say guilty is so devastating.
Julie was breathless, waiting for just one tiny word.
I'd been kind of trying to practice in my head, what will it sound like to hear the word not? Not, you know, we'd always heard guilty. So I'd kind of just fantasized about hearing that word.
And that's exactly what she and everybody else in the courtroom heard that day. The word not, as in not guilty, once, twice, three times.
You hear the first one, and then you hear the second one, and you're praying to God. You hear the third one, and that's when I lost it. You know, knowing finally the truth has prevailed. Justice for Kim and Brad and Jill, for me, for my family, and I just fell to pieces.
Not guilty.
Not guilty.
13 years.
Times three. Yes, sir. 13 years. 13 years of hell.
Everybody around me, I looked, was crying. Dave was bawling. I just sat there. I think I was finally saying, we've got this thing done. Finally.
For the other side, the parents, the grandparents, the verdict was a devastating blow.
When they said not guilty, that's kind of like, it ripped my heart out right there. I mean, like, this can't be right. What did these jurors see that the other 24 jurors in the past didn't see? You know, he was convicted twice by 24 different people. And these 12 people seeing something that they didn't see.
David, can you tell me how you're feeling right now?
Outside, the cameras were waiting.
This is complete vindication after 13 horrific years.
This is a miracle. My situation is a miracle that we are here conducting this interview right now. God literally had to move a mountain to make this happen.
But that mountain would never have moved without dedicated attorneys and Uncle Sam Lockhart.
You know, I have been a lot of people saying the only reason I'm doing this is because Dave's my nephew. Well, that's a big reason, absolutely. But I know he's innocent. He didn't do it. And the only thing I knew to do then was continue to fight until we reached the solution that was proper.
Finally, the David Camp case, one that had dominated the news in southern Indiana for years, was over.
Your name will be clean again, but you know, there's still going to be people that are going to point at you and whisper and say that's the guy that got away with killing his family.
You know what? I can't help those people. If they choose to be ignorant, that's on them. I've had 13 years of my life taken away from me, and it's their problem if they choose to be ignorant, and it is a choice.
For those who knew and loved Kim, Brad, and Jill, there remains a yearning to know what might have been for the wife and mother, for the two young children.
No telling what Kim might have been, where she could have been, what the kids have been doing. We lost all that. Dave lost all that.
David Camp says he'll never get over the pain of what happened in the garage that night.
The pain becomes a part of you, and you live with it, and it's an element of who I am, you know, and, you know, how I live my life.
On the day of the verdict, as a security precaution, sheriff's deputies drove David to a prearranged truck stop and turned him over to his waiting Uncle Sam.
That was the moment he was really free, wasn't it?
I think so. I think it finally hit him, and it hit me, like, this guy no longer is in shackles. This guy is with me. He is now ready to go start his life.
It's me and one man leaving together, heading home.